Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Welcome, Talia, to the Autism Roundtable. Thank you so much for joining us today. You come with many hats in the autism community. Please share with us your personal background and your professional background.
Oh, okay. So personal background. So I've gotten a very eclectic mix of neurodivergence in my family. So I went on a journey with my two teenage boys with discovering their autism. I saw their quirks and differences and traits when they were younger, didn't quite understand. Always thought of autism as textbook, that kind of deadpan face and not the eye contact, and you know, somebody that is most of the time a boy that's dim. So I had these kind of stereotypes, and it took me a while to start learning. So as I learnt, as they got older, I then started learning about myself and my husband and my siblings and my parents. So yeah, it's a whole mixed bag. But so yeah, I appreciate the fact that I learned through my boys, and I'm sure other people can relate to that.
I'd be surprised how many adults I meet that tell me that they got their diagnosis late in life. Like, yes. You hear it all the time, and that's interesting that your children inspired you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I unpicked so many things and can relate to things. And obviously you must see what any parent will see, oh, they're like me because of that, or you know, their chin is the same as me, their, you know, their laugh is the same as me, you know, you can see those things, can't you? So actually it's the same in those cases as well. You know, their shyness was a little bit like me, or their learning styles were similar to me. You know, it's just things you start to pick up on. So then along that journey, I realized I needed to be there for them a lot more. And I needed flexibility. Working in the in industry was not flexible, and especially pre-COVID, because everybody 9 to 5 at a desk type thing. And living and working near London, I was commuting quite a lot too. So a lot of my time was taken up. So I needed something that would work for me and my family. So that's what kind of changed my trajectory of what I do. So I worked in business improvement in industry. And I took that business improvement. We've got something called Lean Six Sigma in the UK. I'm sure you've probably got it in the States too. And the common practices on how to streamline and do things more efficiently. So it meant I could do that with people with small businesses and to help them. And so hence I ended up being a coach, because it made sense for me to personally help people with their businesses. But along that journey of discovery.
So what kind of coaching are you doing?
So I'm now a neurodivergent coach, working with business women predominantly, but also families. But I started out as just business. And then because of my kids and the learning and the courses and so much that was going on in the background, I understood there's so many people like myself that have got kids that are neurodivergent, that start their own business because of flexibility and because they've got so many doctor's appointments and so many things that are happening with their kids, that they need to be there for them, and they can't be sending them to after school clubs and early morning breakfast clubs, because actually these kids need a bit more of time at home and not to be overstimulated in such a way, and long hours is too much for them. I mean, you don't have to, you can be neurotypical and that can be too much for you as well, but especially when you've got kids that are a little bit different. So yeah, that's what meant for me, that actually if I built my own business, I could and started coaching in that way, I could help the people that were very similar to me, that I'd learned so much, I wanted to help them to do it in a more easier fashion, you know, and not have to go through some of the struggles that I'd gone through. So hence why I kind of narrowed it down to women that have also got neurodivergent kids or are neurodivergent themselves.
Wow. And what are you doing when you're coaching? Like, what are your main focuses?
So at the end, the main aspect of it is to get somebody from where they are to where they want to be. So whether that's in life, because you dream of having a sit down meal with your kids that isn't such a hard work, whether that's to do with the food or the atmosphere or the conversation or the timing or the lighting or the noise, whatever it is. if you dream of that and maybe that's what you want to work on, or whether it's bedtime routines and you'd love to be that to be a success and for your kids to be sleeping better, or whether that's a female running a business and you want to be able to do it and set yourself boundaries and not feel exhausted and not feel like you're doing it 24/7 and 7 days a week and striving to bring in an income and it not happening and it feeling so disheartening and exhausting. So, and at the same time, if you've got kids at home that have got those needs, yeah, that kind of tops it up, doesn't it?
It's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. And I'm sure you can relate to that.
Yes, I went on a similar journey as far as opening my own business when I had my third. So I have six children.
I remember you saying that. It's amazing.
And when I had my third, I was working in the hospital for like 10 hours a day. And I said, this is just not a way to parent. Mm. And so it inspired me to go ahead and open up my own practice. And I'm very grateful for the children and for encouraging me to open my own practice, because it's been such a lovely journey.
Yeah. No, it's something I'm grateful for too. I totally appreciate that. It does. Yeah. The fact that you've kind of been on that journey and it took you somewhere that you were unexpected. It's lovely, isn't it? So, yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. So
tell us a little bit about your inspiration to do this coaching and how you came up with the idea.
So what happened was, I was business coaching. And what I didn't realize that my methods, my approach, my conversation, my persona, whatever it was, the mixture of these things, I was attracting people that were like me, people that were neurodivergent or had autistic or ADHD kids, or had challenges of their own with running their business and the overwhelm. And after a couple of years, I looked back and thought, hold on a minute. That lady had an autistic son. That lady was ADHD. That lady had a sister that was also ADHD. So I started looking at it thinking, oh, they might not have actually been neurodivergent themselves, but they definitely had a very close member of their family that they were supporting that were. So I realized actually I'm attracting these people because of who I am and the way I work. And people are referring clients to me because of that as well. So I also then started getting referrals, a number of mother and daughters that wanted to come and talk to me about their situation, their communication, their late discovery, how they could work to communicate better, to adjust things in life, to make things easier, whether that's at home, whether that's at work, whether that's with grandchildren. So there was any number of things that came up. So, yeah, it was intentional and unintentional. So it just became more and more comfortable to work with people that I had more of an affinity with and that I knew that their situation.
Wow. Beautiful. Okay. And tell us a little bit about like maybe one or two different case studies or clients that you've worked with and how you've helped them. Like maybe just break it down. Like what kind of things are private businesses struggling with and what kind of supports are out there for them?
Okay, so I recently worked with a lady that runs a mindfulness business, and she was setting it up. She'd finished her master's in mindfulness, and she wanted to set up a business and with a slightly different approach. She is from a neurodivergent family, so her approach was naturally slightly different from some others, but there were so many benefits to helping those people in the community. She's very passionate. So when she came to me, she was there were certain things like her website and her boundaries and processes that she wasn't sure which angle to take and which direction to go in, and things like LinkedIn that she was like, well, how can I talk about what I do and share what I do with this kind of audience that I don't necessarily feel comfortable with? Because a lot of LinkedIn, if you change your career, you've got the wrong type of connections. So we talk through how she would feel comfortable and what she would want to say and who should we want to say it to, until she got to the point where she understood who she should be reaching out to and connecting to and feeling more comfortable, surrounded by people that actually understood the benefit of what she does and she could relate to, and they could relate to her, if that makes sense. So there are certain things that were kind of like light bulb moments that helped her to come out of her shell a bit and to show the world what she was doing. And then she became more intentional about what she wanted to share and who she wanted to help and the service she wanted to provide. So that's one recently, and her website looks fantastic. We went through her branding and, you know, the look and the feel, and it was lovely. It, really nice to see that journey for her and to help her develop that. So that was one.
I just stay organized and focused on the topic of that's at issue and really problem solve in the right area.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and target who she wanted to support and how she wanted to do it. It was lovely to see that evolve for her. So and then so another example would be a family that I'm working with at the moment that have got twins, and one is neurodivergent and one is not, and it's quite an interesting experience for them and also to support them. So the twin that is neurodivergent is quite reliant on her sibling, and it's interesting to go through that with the mother, who's unsure about how she's treating them and whether that should be equal and how she does things differently for one and the other, and to make sure that school is supporting her child, even down to little things in the school classroom. What I've experienced with many clients is that actually just sitting them in a slightly different position and maybe explaining things slightly clearer to them, making sure that they have maybe a few extra breaks or a few jobs so they get up and move about and they've got a sense of responsibility and it builds their confidence. Just little things to help her to go back to school with and say, okay, can we do this? Can we do that? Could she come out of class earlier and go to lunch before everybody else does so that she doesn't experience the chaos and the sense of the overwhelm with the noise and the smells and things? So it's pretty... It might sound minor, but when you have all these things as a collective for children, it actually has, they combust at the end of the day, you know. So I'm sure you've experienced that and seen that. I call it the Coke bottle effect. I'm sure you've probably got something similar, you know, when a child, you shake it and shake it and shake it and they get home and that transition from school, you take that lid off and then they explode, you know. So, and it's hard for parents when they've got this child that actually needs to regulate and they get home and they're unmasking and all of a sudden everything comes out and their emotions have been really suppressed during the day. So it's hard. They need time to reestablish the nervous system a bit, you know?
Yes, and that's huge. Understanding the nervous system and understanding how we do need to really take into consideration what's going on that nervous system and how much children are putting effort in to functioning throughout the day.
Absolutely. So that's some of the stuff that I've been working on with her to help her to kind of help her daughter feel a bit more settled and not so dysregulated, and understanding that she's got a really busy social day with family, for instance, like a barbecue, that to factor in that the next day she's going to need a bit of downtime to kind of rest and process and feel relaxed and not have that social overwhelm and that burnout. It's all about helping her to understand her daughter better so that their relationship together and as a family is easier and simpler and more enjoyable.
Wow. Okay, so I'm going to transition to your personal parenting experience. Tell us a little bit about your two lovely children that you told us about. Let's hear a little bit about your journey when you found out that they were neurodivergent and what steps you felt helpful in the process and in the journey.
So My eldest son was about 18 months when I kind of started picking up on a few nuances in terms of language and the way he described things and the way he noticed things. His hearing is very acute, so he would pick up on noises and bird sounds and even down to the fridge noises. And he would describe things like the number 8, he'd call it a snowman number. So there'd be just a few quirky things he'd do. And I... The first diagnosis for myself was dyslexia, and that was when I was at university. So I just thought, oh, maybe he's like me, he's dyslexic. My dad's also dyslexic, so I thought, okay, it makes sense. So that's what I kind of put it down to about these quirky things. Then we got, and so his reading, he definitely struggled. Focus, he struggled with. He was quite shy. We went to parties. I didn't even realize that was a thing until later when I realized it's the overwhelm, the unknown, the noise, you know, the loudness, the chaos. Yeah. And then when we got to school, we went through a bit more of a journey trying to unpick it, and they weren't very supportive. They didn't really see it. And like many kids, he probably masked quite a lot at school. So yeah, it took quite a while until I then started talking to other parents, thinking, oh, my child does that as well. My child does that as well. Realizing that there were other neurodivergent kids and starting to understand and look outside of the box a bit. So yeah, it took quite a while. But then I started doing parenting courses. And that, because they suggest that our NHS, our health system, they suggest that you go on parenting courses. And I actually work for the charity now that I did the courses with, because I valued so much of what I learned from them. And then I wanted to give back. So it's a very rewarding to do that. So there's a local charity called Advance that I work with.
I love that, because I feel like all of us, regardless of wherever we are on the spectrum of having children, of education, like there's no manual for how to parent. You know, you have a manual to every other thing. The bullet that I got the other day has a manual, and the Lego set has a manual, but how to raise children, we don't have a manual.
If there was, it'd be a bit deceiving, wouldn't it? Because neurodivergent children are so different, but then every child is very different. It's not like one autistic child is the same as the next autistic child. So actually, I didn't think it'd be fairly impossible, wouldn't it, to get a manual?
To get the manual, right? But just even the ideas and the emotional support behind it, I think, are so valuable when you go to parenting classes and you hear that other people are struggling with the same thing, and other people are also not finding this a walk in the park.
And I really did appreciate my own situation, because some of the stories that came out was like, whoa. And I thought I had my challenges, but you know, you've got these children that are really erratic and quite hyper and really hard to manage and to, you know, are unhappy. So I was very grateful that of the situation I was in, because the challenges that other parents had were so much worse. But in the same moment, I was also discovering that my youngest child was autistic, and I hadn't even considered he was. I was busy looking and watching my eldest, thinking that he's having his challenges. My youngest was kind of going through school socially fine, educationally fine, and wasn't really showing the same signs as my other child. The signs he was showing was that he didn't like food and textures and smells, and he was uncomfortable with his clothing. We needed to take labels out, and he didn't like certain socks and certain shoes and things like that. So to me, they weren't typical. And I was just like, oh, he's just sensitive, you know. So but then I went on this course and I thought, hold on a minute, you're telling me and teaching me about autism and ADHD, and my youngest child is more this person than my eldest is. So what's going on? So yeah, it was very helpful to do the course and to have a better understanding. And then, yeah, that ripple effect on everybody else that was around me, and thinking, oh, this is my normal, because everybody is in this umbrella, under this umbrella of neurodivergence. So this is why I'm not seeing it like everybody else does.
Wow. Wow. Okay. And you mentioned that you're dyslexic.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what that means.
So for me, dyslexia is very much to do with memory and reading. So if I'm reading a book, I can read the whole page and I can forget what I've read within minutes. I can also jumble up some of the meaning of it. I've read it and I haven't really absorbed it in the right way, and I've interpreted it maybe in the wrong way. It can be really, really exhausting for me to read. Because I'm trying to process in a slightly different way from other people. But then that memory of it. So when I did my dissertation for university, when I was writing my own words, even at that point, not even just reading a textbook, I was writing my own thesis. I would read pages of it and think, oh, what was it on the last chapter that I wrote? And what was it, my results? And what do I need to compare here? And even to this day, like, I think I did it obviously years and years ago, and I picked it up a little while ago and found it electronically on my computer, and I started reading it thinking, did I write this? It doesn't feel like me. No, surely I didn't write this. It feels really, really peculiar. I write regular emails and articles and blogs for work, and I sometimes go back and read it. I think, no, surely someone wrote that for me. I didn't write this. So my memory is really peculiar. Even just down to dates and birthdays, names really badly. Like, I can walk into a room and be introduced to five people and I've forgotten those five names within minutes. So when people have got name badges, I really appreciate it. It can be really challenging.
It can be challenging. And it's so interesting because I always felt like, I always heard that dyslexia was a reading-based disorder, and you're putting it on memory.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because that's it. Even for myself, I've researched it more and I've watched documentaries even recently. And I hear people talking about their dyslexia and what it means to them. It's also about mapping and planning and walking and following instructions. It can be really challenging as well. And when you don't realize that that's something linked to something different about you, I just presumed that everybody experiences that. And until I have even though he's a neurodivergent child, I have a child that's very good at maps and directions and memorizing roads and which way to go. And so I realized that actually, no, that's me because of my dyslexia. And I get a bit confused and a bit lost. I'm not a big fan of sat-nav, and most people find that really easy. But putting on Google to tell me where to go, sometimes I'm looking at it thinking, what are you telling me to do? I don't understand.
Between all this telephone, yeah, exactly.
Like, I don't know my left and my right either, so that's terrible. I always have to remember. And that could be really challenging. If I'm not wearing a watch or I'm not wearing certain jewellery to help me to remember my left and right, that can be challenging as well. So yes, dyslexia is a lot bigger than what people realise. You know, there's a slight executive function aspect to it as well, in the same breath as ADHD has, they have challenges with executive functions too. So it's there is a definite links there.
Wow. Okay. Very interesting, because you're teaching me new things, being that like I said, with dyslexia, I've always thought of it as really a reading-based disorder.
Mm-hmm.
That
is definitely the stem of it and the core of it for me. And I'm definitely slow at reading and can struggle with it and get exhausted by it and don't want to read. You give me a long document, I'm like, oh, please don't make me do that. So I listen to Audible books. For the longest time, I absolutely love books, and especially with big imaginative stories in them. When I was younger, reading Harry Potter was such a pleasure. But I do get exhausted by it, which is a good thing if I want to go to sleep. So that helps. But I've discovered that Audible books are so much more pleasurable for me because I don't have to read and I can still use my imagination with the description, and it can be more fun.
I love audiobooks. We also do them in our house. And I love that it gives you the ideas and the information and the imagination. And for children that are struggling with reading, it's definitely a nice alternative.
Yeah, absolutely.
What other alternatives have you found to be helpful with your dyslexia?
I found electronic diaries really, really helpful, and putting everything in, like as much detail as possible about the appointment, the times, the links or the locations, the people that I'm going to talk to, that kind of thing. And reminding myself to maybe send emails beforehand, so because I'm not necessarily going to remember a few days beforehand. So using that as my memory is really helpful. And then also just using things like WhatsApp. I have a WhatsApp group for myself. And so I'll put lots of things in there, like links to go back to as references. I find that really helps too. If I need to remember to buy eggs or milk or something like that, I will say it out loud, and whoever's in the room, I'm like, remember to remind me to buy eggs. You know, so they're my memory too. That definitely helps. But we've got a chalkboard in the kitchen. Sometimes that's helpful. I write things down. You know, I've got at the top, it's written memory. So yeah, the kids have got a party on the weekend, remember to do this, you know, go and pick up a new outfit or a present or whatever it is. So that side of things. But yeah, the audible books is big, a big part of it too. So being able to do things all visually with films instead of going for books is definitely helps. I've got a stack of books in my app that I haven't read that I constantly look at and think, oh, I want to read you, but I'm just not got the energy. I'll do it when I'm on holiday and I'm not working and I can switch off, and that's when I really enjoy a book.
And really focus and attend and put all my energy.
Yeah, exactly. I've got lots of distractions. I haven't got, I need to, you know, clean the bathroom. Oh, I need to do the laundry. Oh, I need to go shopping. Oh, I need to go pick up the books, the boys. You know, it's not all those things aren't coming in and intruding my time as I read. So actually it's a lot easier.
Wow. Okay, continue your journey with your children. You mentioned your younger son, so you noticed that he was also showing signs.
Yes. Not the typical ones that you'd necessarily pick up on, because like his eye contact was there. It wasn't exactly not there. You know, he would chat. He was really sociable, loved being with friends. So it just didn't make sense. But then he's got this way about him when it comes to talking, which I put down to ADHD, but it can be autism as well. But he just won't stop. He just doesn't stop. He gets passionate about things, especially gaming, and he just won't stop. And I didn't realize that was a thing, you know. So I often say to him, can I join in with the conversation here? You know, is there a breath? You know, can I ask a question? I'm curious. I've learned, especially because my husband can do the same thing, I've learned that I need just to cut in, you know, just go for the jugular and just, you know, if I'm going to get a word in edgeways, I just need to, it feels rude, but I just need to cut in and start talking and joining in the conversation. So otherwise I'll just get stuck there for hours. I started to pick up certain things that he was doing that I hadn't really identified as neurodivergent before. And like I said before, because I lived it and it was my normal, I didn't really realise the extent of how much neurodivergence was in our house, you know. And so I'm sure for looking outside in, you'd see it all and think, oh my goodness, this is a very peculiar home. The way they communicate, the way they do things. But it was my normal. So I was used to it.
I was getting ready to say, normal is so relative. I'm like, what is normal? My husband says to me, like, you know, you said the word normal, like, who do you know that's normal? Like, what is normal, right? Because like at the end of the day, we're all living our lives, we're all living our journey, and whatever that journey is our normal.
Yeah, exactly. So this is my normal. And so it took me a very long time to realize my normal is not the same as everybody else's. So yeah, I'm not really normal to everybody else, but I am to me. So that works. So then, I just started discovering more and more and picking up on things that both my children were doing differently but the same, and how they communicate with each other and their friends and their behaviours. And it's become almost like a hyper-focus for me, because it's become such a special interest in terms of understanding how it works and finding out the other things that come with it, like pathological demand avoidance, OCD, rejection sensitivity, all these things that I start digging deeper and deeper and think, oh, that's what that is. And, you know, that's why you behave in that particular way. And that's why you don't like asking for something. Or, you know, it's just, there's so many things to unpick. And it helps me understand my family even more, and myself too. So it's really interesting. And, you know, I could, you know, go on for days.
No, it is wonderful. And do you find that understanding the root helps you?
Oh, tremendously. Yes.
Running a functional home?
Yeah, absolutely. But also then on the knock-on effect when I'm dealing with the clients that I'm supporting, I also run a networking group. So there's such an array of different personalities and behaviours, and I can read the room. It really helps me to understand people and how comfortable and uncomfortable they are about certain things. And the same with my kids, understanding, like, if we go to certain places, that the noise levels and the smells and the vastness of it can be really uncomfortable for them. So let's choose something that is going to be comfortable. Being outdoors with my children is really easy. They love being outdoors, and it's the nature is so much more predictable in some ways, although, you know, you never know when it's going to rain, but in the sense that you they feel very comfortable. So, and it's
comfortable, and also almost there's no expectation outdoors. I mean, you can't hurt another child, but the expectations of outdoors, you could use your voice how you want it, you could run freely, you could explore all the sensory things that you want to explore, and no one's like, shh, sit down, be quiet, in your voice. Like,
and you must find that with your six children, if you go out for a meal, for instance, that must be really challenging, because you want to keep them all happy.
We very rarely go out with all six children to a restaurant. That is just not a supportive environment.
You could come today, but not you.
The in-home restaurant. I'll cook, and we all sit at the table and do what we want to do and have that conversation. Or, like you said, go to a park and do it outside.
Yes.
Your yard.
Picnic,
but not
the way to go.
I'm not overwhelming my sensory systems with all my children.
It's not enjoyable for you then, is it? Because
no, and it causes so much anxiety. And I think that understanding that as a parent is huge, that we have to understand that we have to be in a good sensory space and we have to be in a good emotional space in order to help to regulate our children and to make them feel comfortable in each situation they're in. And if we put ourselves in an environment that is not supportive of us or our children, it's not good for anyone.
No, absolutely. I've got a family that I was supporting recently, and she was telling me how when they went on long journeys, which they regularly do because they've got family that have got a boat near the coast, so they'd go for a long journey in the car, and it was really uncomfortable and really stressful to do it. And the children would fight and they'd be screaming and shouting and, you know, dysregulation, and mum would feel nervous and unhappy. And she explained that they stopped in a park on the way, and she didn't understand what happened, but everybody kind of blew up, you know, and it didn't go well, and we unpicked it. And a lot of it was about mum's anxiety, you know, that she didn't know where she was, that they'd parked away from where dad was. She had the dogs, she had the kids. You know, one was running that way, one was running that way. She was dysregulated and tired from the car journey. And so actually then it had the knock-on effect that the kids picked up on her energy and they started feeling upset and started fighting with each other. So once you start to understand and look at it holistically, then you realise actually what can we do differently next time? You know, making sure that the kids are well fed and they've got a drink and they sit down and they're, you know, they've got a minute, and that mum can just sit and wait and not have to run. And, you know, mum's also got food and a drink, and, you know, they know where the toilets are, and just a little bit of planning and kind of looking forward to see that they're going to be able to handle the situation.
Yeah, foreplanning in all situations with children is like so important. And I always think, like, when I'm trying to get out of the house with all the kids, I actually took them swimming yesterday at a pool, and I said I'll be there say 5:30, and I didn't get there till 6, because till you get the goggles, because there's going to be a fight about the goggles, until you get the right swim cover-ups and the swim towels and the by the time I got out that door, and I was like, oh my goodness. And then I said, hey, like, what am I rushing for? So we'll swim a half hour later, but we'll be well prepared, and then
the children will be happier. Like, everybody's going to have what they want. So yeah, absolutely.
Right.
So much better that way.
I do think that's a big piece in parenting, is the pre-planning and learning from our experiences and realizing what sensory experiences work and what sensory experiences don't work, and planning as such.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the other big keys that I found for anybody, whether it's a businesswoman or a woman that's got a neurodivergent family, or that actually to not conform to what everybody else is doing.
I think we
follow this road and this journey, and we're doing everything that everybody else does, and not stopping to realize, actually, my family are unhappy and this doesn't work for us. Instead of thinking, well, everybody else is doing it, so I'm going to do it too. Like going to the cinema or to the theater or going for a meal at a restaurant, you know, doing typical things that other people do. Well, everybody else does it, so we'll do it too. But if you're repeatedly going to a restaurant and it's really not a very enjoyable situation, to wake up and realize, why am I doing this? Like, why do I feel like, yes, well, the Joneses down the road, they had a very nice Italian meal, so we're going to do it too. But no, it's not going to work for you. It's really not. And it's okay that it doesn't, that you can do things differently.
Yeah, and I do think it's a skill that we learn through experience of really being self-thinkers and stopping and reassessing each situation for the situation that it is. And just because it worked in the past or it worked for somebody else doesn't mean that that's going to work for you. And you could try it, because if everyone's loving chocolate ice cream and you feel like you want to try that chocolate ice cream, then go for that chocolate ice cream and try it. But if you don't really like it and it doesn't do it for you and you want to try vanilla, go for vanilla. Try it.
Yes.
And maybe that's going to work for you better.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't have to defend that. You can say, yeah, well, you know what? I prefer vanilla and that works for me. And I think we hide behind that and think, oh, you know, we have to find a reason to justify why we've chosen vanilla. But no, you know what? I'm just not a chocolate person. That's not true, by the way.
I also preferred chocolate my whole life until I got married. And then my husband loves vanilla and he's kind of convinced me, but I think I like chocolate.
Yeah. Well, you can have both as your favorite now.
Exactly. With the swirl.
Yeah. Lovely. I love that.
But I do love that point too, that like really we don't have to answer to society, and we have to answer to ourselves and what functionality is for us and whatever that means to us. And I see a lot of times in practice and even just with friends and family where I see people like justifying their children, saying, oh, he only does this because the ex, oh, usually he does this.
Yeah.
And I feel like I almost want to tell them,
yeah,
no, just own it. Be proud of it.
Yeah, absolutely. It comes up in so many different situations, doesn't it? Like when you're in the supermarket and the child is dysregulated, or if they're organizing the shelves, which my child does, you know, it's okay. It's okay for them to be different. You don't have, as parents, I think we start feeling a bit embarrassed or a bit, we don't want that attention. We don't want people to, we're scared of what people think of us. We start trying to defend it when actually, no, it's actually okay. And you don't have to be the same as everybody else. And just to be there for your child and support your child, and instead of maybe reacting in a what you think society wants you to react in, and then it makes the situation worse for you and your child.
Exactly. Love the points. Love it. Okay, now you also mentioned maybe autism and ADHD together, right, with one of your children. Tell us a little bit about how that presents, how you got that diagnosed.
So actually, I don't have it diagnosed. That's okay. So in the UK, we have a term called ADHD. So ADHD is a combo, and it's not technically something that the doctors use as a term, but it's definitely becoming more and more of a thing. I actually want, for myself, I want an ADHD with dyslexia, because I feel like I'm predominantly probably dyslexic, but I've definitely got autistic and ADHD traits. So I just want a name for all of it, you know, so I need a new one. Yes. As well as my kids, I do have lots of families that do have kids with a combo. And so sometimes you do distinctly have the two separate. But quite often, if they're together, you will have a child that goes up and down, like sways, you know. So sometimes they'll have an autistic day. Some days they'll have an ADHD day. And some days it's just like a combo. And I think it's beautiful, really, because it's almost like slightly two different personalities. Like the autism doesn't want to go to a party, but actually the ADHD is quite happy to go to a party, you know. So it's like, okay, autism, you're going to stay at home today, but me and my ADHD, we're going to that party and we're going to enjoy it, you know. So it's just having those differences and recognizing the beauty in having those traits that complement each other. And some will come out more than others, and you can have a bit of a social burnout, and actually you'll need to have an autistic day where you can just be quiet and calm and do your reading and be at peace. And the other times where you're having your excitable, running around, jumping, enjoying, singing, laughing, and your ADHD time. So, yeah, I find it's quite lovely to have these things that complement.
Wow. Wow. Now, as a parent and as a job coach, what kind of traits, skills you think are really important to teach children in order to be functional adults? Like, we're raising children, and we want, as a parent, I know for myself, and I'm sure most parents out there, we hope that they're going to be a part of society and that they're going to be able to be independent. What are some of those skills that you are focusing on for your children and you focus on in your work in order for individuals to really be functional adults?
So to me, it's very simple, but it's very hard to implement and very hard to be brave with and to be accepted by. So what I mean is, it's simple in the fact that if you stand up and say, you know what, I need to wear ear defenders, I need to sit somewhere that is not by the door, I need to not burn out my social battery, so actually I'm not going to come to every single meeting that you have, only to the ones that are really important to me, you know, I'm going to maybe need to work on my own for a little while and not in the team, and then come back and deliver what I need to deliver. It's being able to figure out the things that will help you to achieve better. It can be down to clothing. It can be times of the day that you work, because if you're ADHD, quite often it's really not uncommon to be late and to miss your bus and to maybe take the wrong journey or to not find a parking space or things like that. So if you can speak to your boss and say, you know what, 9 o'clock's really not going to work for me, I'm going to be late every single day. But if you say to me that I can be here between 9 and 10 every day, you're going to see me every single day, and I'm just going to work the hours, and I'll stay until later to make sure I've worked to the missed bit. So it takes the stress, the anxiety away, and actually the boss is going to get the best out of you. So it's just being able to voice those little things that can make a massive difference. You know, I'm not a suit and tie person. I'm going to turn up with just a shirt and slacks on every day, and pants or trousers or whatever you call it in the US. So if you can do those things to help you feel regulated, and you can talk to somebody that is going to listen and to take it on board and to be accepting, and that's big, then you are going to strive and thrive.
Yes. And I think it's important also to recognize that every individual has needs, and maybe sometimes, you know, we have past experience that made us feel so different in one way or another, and therefore we're almost scared to voice our opinion, our thoughts, our wants, our needs. And I love that empowering message, that it is so important to have those conversations, because then you'll have that much more of a successful journey at whatever it is that journey is.
Yeah, absolutely. Fortunately, there are some really big corporations out there that are turning to neurodivergent people and saying, we want you. They're recognizing that actually that a neurodivergent person can, they're not as linear, and they think outside of the box, they come up with ideas. And that's definitely something I've discovered as a dyslexic person, that I'm an ideas person on the spot. You know, I'm a problem solver, and I'll do that very, very quickly. And there's been a number of people that will react to that, like, oh, how did you manage that? How did you come up with that solution so quickly? And, you don't realize that actually you are somebody that kind of thinks slightly differently on your feet. It's a bit like engineers and electricians in particular. Apparently a dyslexic engineer and electrician, they'll visualize their wirings and their routings and things, and they can do things and see things and slightly different way than perhaps a neurotypical. So it's simple to them because of their visual ability and their attention to detail. So more and more, I think employees are picking up on these things and realizing it. It's just finding somewhere that will accept you for who you are and want those skills and want you for that reason.
Also, if we look at the autism population, we see a lot of special interests,
yes,
right?
That hyper-focus, oh my God. I mean, we have something, a quiz called Mastermind in the UK, where you get like 20 questions and you have to answer them really quickly. And those people that know Star Wars, you know, in every detail, and they can answer the questions, it's like, it's amazing. and they can do that with airplanes and whatever else. It's fantastic.
So imagine if you're working with your special interest, then you know so much. I mean, you don't want it either to be like hyper focused, and like there's definitely reasons why maybe special interests can't work, but I could imagine if your special interest is what you work in, you'll probably be really good at it too.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then it brings you joy anyway, because you're doing something that you're so passionate about and that you love, and you get paid to do it. So how amazing is that?
How amazing is that? Exactly. Okay. So I think that you shared with us such beautiful thoughts, and I really enjoyed our conversation today. You really had such insightful understanding as an individual with neurodiversity, as with children with neurodiversity, and someone that works in the field helping people that are neurodiverse. So you really come with so much knowledge. If you have to leave off with one message for individuals on the spectrum and their caregivers, what would it be?
I think it goes back to those social norms, and to make sure that you take a step back and look at what you're doing that is uncomfortable for you, uncomfortable for your family, is not working, and understand why that is and maybe how you could do it differently. And it's okay if that means putting your children to bed at 11 o'clock at night when everybody else does it at 8. You know, it's okay if it means your child eats alone in the kitchen because, you know, they're too sensory to do it at the table with everybody else. Even though society expects us to do things in certain ways, it's okay to do it differently for you and your family.
I love that message. Thank you so much, Talia, for coming on today.
Thank
and
you
for sharing your thoughts and feelings. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's lovely talking to you.